Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Velkommen til Liberal halvtime. Mitt navn Lars Peder Nordbakken, og jeg vert I dag. Med meg har jeg kollega Guy Kiddy, som ved siden av å skrive om Norden og Baltikum for The Economist, også bidrar med samfunnspolitisk analyse I Civita. Og da kan jeg vel si med en gang at dere hører kanskje på navnet hans at han ikke norsk I utgangspunktet. Han kommet fra Irland opprinnelig, og hadde vi hatt denne samtalen her på høsten, så jeg sikker på at vi kanskje hadde hatt den på norsk. Men nå har vi blitt enige da, om å ha denne på engelsk, så dette blir en podcast som innholdet blir hovedsakelig på engelsk. La meg også nevne helt innledningsvis at denne podcastepisoden den første av I alt tre fortløpende episoder om det samme hovedtema, om vi trenger en ny samfunnskontrakt for fremtiden, som på engelsk social contract. Guy, welcome to Liberal Halvtime.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And let me start by saying that certainly, as the saying goes, we are living through transforming times in many ways, and with a certain potential for disruptions in many areas of society, economy, lives, and certainly big changes. And in one way, let me start also by saying, reflecting on public opinion research in this country done for several years, asking people how do they actually feel about the state of affairs in this country all in all? How satisfied are they with the overall situation in the country? And there is no big trace of anything really broken in that sense, because since 2011, I think about 73% of the Norwegian public seems to be reflecting that they are satisfied with the conditions in society.
I mean, that's certainly, certainly the impression that we get from overseas. And if you look at all the rankings of happiness in the world, then Norway more or less always comes out top. People here seem to be very satisfied with life and the way things are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And certainly you're well known that the high trust we have in society generally and to institutions is part of that. But there is a but. Because in many of these opinion research projects, there are also questions about the future. And how do you think, will the future actually, do you have a feeling that the future will be a better future? Or would it be a more problematic or pessimistic future? And there is an interesting paradox, because there was a shift somewhere between 2013 and 2015, where you see that the optimists were losing out versus the pessimists. Mm-hmm. So actually now we see that there are much more people are feeling a sense of uncertainty and worry more about the future, more pessimistic about the future prospects. And certainly you also find official documents by the government saying that, you know, the future sustainability of the welfare state is also, you have to, there are risks there as well, demographic change and so on. But the thing is, we're talking now very much about the future, of course, mm-hmm. and to boil it down to one essential thing, the younger you are, the more likely you are to be more pessimistic about, you know, and worry about climate change, inequality, future work and income prospects, and perhaps also reinforced by the experiences through the pandemic.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think young people have been in the very, in really, really testing times, particularly people are studying and so on. Now I come to you. You are a very recent newcomer to Norway. Very recent, actually.
Just a couple of months. Although I have been visiting the country for many years.
So exactly.
I'm not completely new to the country.
So I'm really tempted to start this by listening to you now. What is your first impression about Norway? What do you find different here, or you have been living in Ireland, you have been living in England most of the time?
Yeah, I have a mixed British and Irish background, and certain elements of Irish society I see here in Ireland. Typically, outside of big cities, you have a great degree of community cohesion and community trust. And that is something that strikes me very strongly about Norway. There are significantly higher degrees of social trust and trust in institutions here than in both countries, but particularly than in the UK. And you see that in the diligence with which people here have been following the coronavirus regulations, for example. Everybody's washing their hands or sanitizing their hands when they go into buildings, masks on public transport. And I can tell you that from the very beginning of the pandemic in the UK, that was not the case. I think it's a bit more of a Wild West attitude in each man for himself in the UK, more of a libertarian approach to things like this, so slightly anarchic perhaps. On the everyday level, you have things like the Dugnad tradition in shared housing blocks, which I think is delightful. Obviously, it's a great community thing, and everybody's contributing to a whole, which is very much the essence of what we're talking about here in terms of the social contract. And then the workplace, you have unbelievably generous terms and degrees of job security that you just don't get anywhere else in the world that I know of anywhere. Things like free education at any age in this hospital. Hospitals that whenever I visited them, at least, which hasn't been very often, but I have visited the odd hospital here, and they've been, you know, working very well and not overcrowded. So that's all the good stuff. I think, though, if you scratch away at the surface, there are some problematic things. You mentioned some of those broad themes that concern particularly young people, but I have to say I notice a certain wastefulness here in Norway. There's an awful lot of waste, particularly plastic waste, I see. Nowhere else have I lived and produced so much plastic waste in a week. Everything is wrapped in plastic here, which kind of flies in the face of the sort of civic-minded behaviour that you'd expect of a society with high social trust, where people are looking out for each other and implicitly, therefore, for the environment and things like that. And then, of course, there's the slightly difficult question of the oil industry and the decades of pollution that effectively Norway has been exporting to the rest of the world. And that's a problem in itself, but it's also a massive macroeconomic problem for Norway, of course, which is something that we're going to come to probably in this episode and the subsequent two episodes.
Mm-hmm. Well, listening to what you say, Guy, I think it's easy to see that you are into the majority of what the opinion poll results are saying also about what Norwegians think about Norway. And that's you have visited Norway before, now you're living in Norway, so you're confirming perhaps more than anything else. By the way, you mentioned oil. A big paradox.
Yeah,
we have become very rich partly because of oil, but perhaps also because how we handled the oil and petroleum industry. And actually, I mentioned the break in the pessimism, the breakup in pessimism curve happening around 2013-14. That's exactly the parallel of when we had the oil price shock. It collapsed.
Yeah.
So there was an extraordinary kind of a pessimism in terms of that big industry has big impact in Norway, was falling a little bit down. But certainly now it's a quite different question that we are posing for the future, that we know we have to get out of it. But before we, we will return to that, obviously, but what we are speaking about in this podcast series here, this mini-series between the two of us, is about the social contract. Certainly, that is not a term that is self-explanatory in any way.
Perhaps we should explore what we mean by that.
Yeah, absolutely. What is your take on that?
Well, the reality is that it's not a clear-cut thing. There are lots of different interpretations, and there have been ever since, for example, Thomas Hobbes started talking about the idea of what he called a social contract. But basically, I think it's the aim of a social contract is to... or the theory of a social contract is to show that members of a society have a reason to endorse and comply with the fundamental social rules, laws, institutions, and so on of a society, that govern a society. And typically, the reasons that people have for agreeing to those rules and those customs are reasons that suit their own agenda. We might say they're slightly selfish reasons. And there's an irony, therefore, that the motive is for subscribing to a social contract is probably mostly selfish, given that the social contract is something that's supposed to unite a population, a whole society. Mm. But as I said, I mentioned Hobbes before, and his view was that man is basically in a wild state, and the only way to tame that man is to have an authoritarian leader, government, so authoritarian state. A near contemporary, John Locke, didn't have such a dim view, probably because he lived in a time that was more peaceful. There were fewer wars and there was less upheaval in society during his lifetime. But yeah, he had faith in the idea of a legislature acting above the sovereign as an expression of the general will. And then we got on to people like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote The Social Contract. And he was more optimistic still. You know, he was the first really to say, well, maybe there's a collective purpose that might appeal over and above this sort of selfish motivation to join in with a social contract. But then again, you have Kant, Immanuel Kant, his near contemporary, who was a bit more Hobbesian and a bit more individualistic about things. And he said that moral autonomy really is what should drive a person to adhere to the precepts that suit everyone. What he called the categorical imperative. And the idea being that if you do something and behave in a way that reflects the way that you'd like people to behave towards you, then that's good for everyone. But of course, that kind of breaks down because different people have different ideas of what's a nice way to behave or be treated.
I have a feeling that you are now centering around a very important aspect or characteristic of a meaningful concept of social contract. That is it basically a reciprocal arrangement that is reciprocal in the way that it gives meaning to me and you and everyone else as a so-called balancing point of some kind between rights and obligations of as citizens.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the term the citizenship concept, how does that get into it?
The idea of citizenship and what we were talking about before, the very high degrees of social trust that you see in Norway and other Nordic nations is a part and parcel of this concept. I think people here have a very strong notion of, okay, this is a high tax country. I'm going to pay a lot of money to the government, to the state in taxes. So is everybody else. But look what we get in return for that. We get excellent public services and we get excellent education and we get excellent healthcare and so on. But it goes over and above that. And this is something that, you know, interests me greatly about Norwegian society. And, you know, where does this come from? Surely this sense of solidarity and shared purpose in society preceded the great welfare state that materialized after the Second World War, and which was inspired actually by William Beveridge, the great British liberal. So that must be something that is kind of inbuilt into the Norwegian psyche, and perhaps it has something to do with the small fishing communities, for example, and agrarian communities that characterize this country before the discovery of oil and the great wealth that came along.
You might say, like some historians in Norway have been saying for some time, that Norway was basically made from the bottom up by small individual property owners, farmers and fishermen, sometimes combined farmers and fishermen. And there was hardly any kind of nobility in Norway compared with Sweden. So a very egalitarian kind of, natural egalitarian kind of structure to it all. That is probably part of it. But anyway, so that goes perhaps easily into a Lockean kind of concept, that it's easy for a country like Norway with this kind of history to join together with the basic rights and obligations and so on. Mm-hmm. But is it more, when you talk about the social contract, I have a sense of feeling that it's a little bit more than the basic constitution or a minimal consensus. It's more about solidarity stretching a little bit in that direction, in a wider sense, is it? Or what do you think?
It has. I mean, if we talk about the Norwegian model or the Norwegian social contract, which isn't defined or written down in any way, it's a collection of, some of it's written down in terms of a constitution, for example, and the various laws that govern the country. But a lot of it is tradition and custom and things like that. But yeah, the kind of, the binding factor is shared values. I think that's what social contracts are about, shared values and the kind of society in which people want to live. We've already said, you know, the idea of the social contract means different things to different people. The Norwegian model means different things to different people. But I think perhaps in essence, it's a combination of that welfare state that came into being after the Second World War with things like the tripartite system, which has big implications for other areas of government work and policy, of course. But on top of that, all of the things that drive people to get involved in the Dugnad tradition, for example, and share that sense of solidarity that has existed for hundreds of years here.
That is also close to the concept of civil society, right? Where we meet independently of the market, independently of the state, but to do common things and around common ideals and try to fix things in the local area or the national area or wherever. If we go into the Nordic model or the Norwegian model, since mm-hmm. we are in Norway, there is of course both a narrow concept of the Norwegian model and a more extended kind of definition of it. The narrow definition you mentioned was the tripartite labor market constitution, which is somehow together with a basic welfare state deal. But the wider one is, of course, the more holistic societal arrangements where we are also talking about what kind of we have a market, an open market economy, a very reliable rule of law, and a liberal democracy that is has a high level of trust from all ranges of society, also across the income distribution, by the way. The narrowness or the wideness of a social contract thinking. Let me insert here just to maybe provoke an idea or two mm-hmm. from you. Of course, it's easy to remember. John Maynard Keynes, the famous British economist, once said in 1926 in an essay, and he was trying to express what he thought was the essence of politics. And he said it's basically to combine three things, and those things being economic prosperity on the one hand, social justice on the other, and individual liberty as the third pillar. One might say perhaps that, you know, the Norwegian or the Nordic model today, and so after the liberal reforms, by the way, happened since the 1970s, is a quite successful translation of that kind of a idea.
I think very much so, yes. Although, as we have already sketched out, there are cracks forming. And that's partly because of the geopolitical situation and globalization, the forces of globalization. It's down to things like climate change and the huge macroeconomic and socioeconomic shifts that's driving. Hmm. But it is perhaps, you mentioned before that there's this high degree of trust across all age groups and classes in Norwegian society. But I've been reading things recently about the working classes in Norway, and you do see some holes forming in the social trust and the degree of trust in governments in among those groups of people. And you know, that's partly because a lot of the kind of work that traditionally the working classes would have done has been automated, of course. And then a lot of stuff that we call kind of working class work, labor, these days is done by guest workers, things like fruit picking. A lot of people who are working in the fishing industry are from Eastern Europe, from the Baltic states and that kind of thing. Seasonal workers, in other words. And that means that all that's left really for those who would have worked in factories and would have labored in a similar way, Norwegians who would have worked in that way, is work in the service industries and hotels and that kind of thing in retail. And you know, as we know, particularly after the pandemic, a lot of those jobs are disappearing and sorely challenged as well. So that's one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum, as we talked about, is young people, many of whom are extremely well qualified and experienced and have lived and worked overseas. yet who are still struggling to find gainful employment. If they can find it, it's for contracts. You know, it's on a contract basis. It's not permanent. It's not a fast stealing, the dream that everyone searches for. And as a result of that, we are definitely getting to a point where, yes, that Keynesian dynamic you mentioned is still alive and kicking in Norway. But can't afford to be complacent. You need to keep out and you need to nurture those three pillars and refine them and refine their meaning and refine the ground on which, or shore up, support the ground on which those pillars stand, so that they continue to be strong and hold up society in the way that we want it to be.
Sure. And as I mentioned initially, the opinion research that indicates that we are now experiencing more and more young people actually worrying more about the future in many ways, also the future work and income prospects and so on. Is certainly also, we know that is also a part of the Norwegian reality. So yeah, I completely follow you on that. We have to be on guard and we have to see what is, how things are developing or how we can mitigate that in an offensive way. So, but are we saying that that the common experience is that was perhaps an easier reality or more predominant in the 1950s and 60s, for example, just to jump far back into the past, where people were carrying on more equal kind of work, and now there is perhaps a tendency for some people, law skilled service work, to be in a completely different kind of social status, mm-hmm. as compared with many others. And there may also be the case that not all the most precarious people in precarious life situations are probably not those who are most vocal in answering opinion false as,
not least
as
because
well.
Too-
so there is a layer upon layer that we could, you know, miss out on. There are genuine problems that we not necessarily see so clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, in some countries we have an upheaval or an uproar in terms of populism. People, a significant part of the people, don't feel they are heard by or listened to by the elites or the politicians, but we don't have that so much in this country.
But, no, not so much. I'm not a great follower of social media, but I'm sure there are plenty of pretty suspect forums out there on the various social media platforms that attract a fair number of keyboard warriors, as I like to call them. And what are we? We're 10 years on now from the Utøya tragedy, atrocity, which was an expression of the most extreme form of populism there is. But it exists here, and we're all aware of that. And there will be hopefully no more Anders Behring Breivik's surfacing in Norway, but there may well be plenty of people who harbour similar sentiments, even if they wouldn't express them in such a violent and atrocious way. So, of course, we have to be vigilant.
Certainly, they are very extreme examples, but yeah. As you say, they are real. I mean, to a horrifying extent. And so, by the way, so we are also circling around the idea of a social cohesion. If there is someone is not inside or feeling inside society, we can have a lot of nasty problems, perhaps. But social cohesion and social contract is a very close concept, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
yeah.
And of course, we have to explore this idea a little bit more in abstract, I think, also, when we talk about the social contract. Certainly, some other thinkers have been thinking a lot about this, the idea of a basic contract that is fair and is so, it's good for most people. I'm thinking about John Rawls and the theory of justice, for example.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yeah. And he had this idea that if we did this thought experiment that we are living behind a veil of ignorance, so we don't know anything about our own social position or past, anything, we would probably be in a better position to say what kind of a society would we like to have. And that would give a more fair picture.
Yeah.
But How is that? I think the veil of ignorance is something we all remember from that book.
Yes.
But probably not the solution.
It's very difficult to put into practice, isn't it? Because, exactly. You know, we're all conditioned by our experiences. But, I mean, maybe there are several dimensions and interdependencies to this idea of a social contract. And I won't list those now, but I think what you're getting at is that we need to find a way of representing that general will, coming to some conception of what would be for most people the ideal society or the ideal compromise, which would give the best standards of liberty, the best standards of economic involvement, the best standards of civil society generally for most people. And you know, perhaps I can make reference to something that happened in one of my countries of citizenship in Ireland, where they have been in recent years making very good use and interesting use of the idea of a citizens' assembly.
Okay.
And there...
Sounds like a very something like... Well, I'm listening to what you're saying now, but, you know, Sen's critique of Rawls was that perhaps it's difficult to have this ideal, but we should be more concerned about the procedures of how we come about making this kind of...
Right, yeah. So I think this is probably as Rawlsian as we can be in a practical way, in reality. And yeah, the question was about abortion in Ireland, about the Eighth Amendment of the Irish Constitution, which basically outlawed abortion in all but the most extreme circumstances. And between the end of 2016 and 17, 99 randomly selected people were invited to take part in this citizens' assembly, and they came from all parts of society, all over the country, different ethnicities, different sexes, sexual persuasion, all those things. And the members of this assembly heard representations, about 300 representations, from all interested parties, from medical experts, from women's rights organizations, from religious organizations. And in the end, the majority of them, 56%, I think it was, recommended amending or replacing that article, that Eighth Amendment article. And they also came up with a kind of framework policy for how abortion should be regulated in Ireland. And then their findings were put to a general referendum, and almost 70% of the Irish population voted in favour, of the voting population voted in favour. So there is one example of how you take what is a very controversial topic and had been stuck in political deadlock in Ireland for decades, and you put it to a representative panel, a form of direct democracy, effectively that's what it is, and with that spread of opinions and that spread of views, you have in the end a compromise position which appeals to a majority of people. And I think you could take that same concept and apply it to this idea of the social contract and ask people, okay, so what is a fair society? What kind of society do we want to live in? And you could consider all dimensions ranging from the things that are very, very obvious when it comes to the social contract, like rules and regulations, constitutions, statutes, customs, and so on, but also things that are much more, I guess, philosophical, like shared values. What's equity? What's fairness? What's a minimum dignified standard of living? What establishes or protects rights in a country? Do you need a kind of Bill of Rights? Does that Bill of Rights go beyond the constitution or give expression to any constitution in the modern day? If you think about the American Constitution, for example, written in the 18th century, quite clearly, when it comes to the right to bear arms, that's rather outdated these days. And I think a social contract could give voice and expression to constitutions in the modern day, and in an ongoing fashion. You could repeat this kind of citizens' assembly every 5 years. It could be something as normal as the election cycle.
It sounds like a new channel for democracy in a minute. Extending democracy, extending the debate, and thereby, in this case, of course, it's astonishing to hear you speak about the Irish example here of abortion debate because it loosened up certainly a lot of locked in situation maybe, and there was a new way to go about finding a majority view and then acting on it.
It loosened up every party involved. Mm. It loosened up ordinary citizens. It loosened up and freed politicians to be the representatives they're supposed to be, because they had this very, very solid mandate, not only from the Assembly, but also from the referendum thereafter. And it, as you said, it gave renewed vigour and enfranchisement, democratic involvement to the Irish people in a way that you see very clearly in Switzerland, for example. They have very many referenda in Switzerland on all sorts of topics. And in fact, you were telling me about this last, Peter. I didn't know so much about it, but on measures of
happiness,
happiness and well-being, yeah. And also feelings of
being in control of your own
being
life.
In control,
yeah, yeah. And, in an extended way.
And having a voice, having a say in society in an extended way. The Swiss out very, very high, high in the list.
Well, having a voice is the central thing of what is the anti-populist medicine in a way. Making sure that we meet and discuss and respect and create a democratic culture. But we cannot avoid, when you mention the Irish example of citizen assemblies, that certainly the main institutions we have to settle questions like that is parliamentary democracy.
Yeah,
in the for national politics, and we struggle to see some kind of international parallels to even be able to make international decisions in a more legitimate way, perhaps. EU being one example, struggling a little bit with a quasi parliament, maybe with the EU parliament, but. Shouldn't we really expect that the main way to go about discussing what the social contract should be is actually the democratic parliament as such? That is, so does it say something about the health of the parliamentary democracy when you have to go to a citizenship council in order to come to some reasonable discussion?
Well, I think it does.
There must be a tension there because, yeah.
Potentially there is. And it's interesting you mentioned this, because in advance of this discussion, I kind of explained what we were going to be talking about today to my girlfriend last night. We're over dinner. And this is exactly the question she asked. She said, well, hang on a second. We already have this. We have elected representatives. And we have a parliament. Yeah. The problem is, of course, that elected representatives are subject to all sorts of external forces and vested interests. A lot of them are in it for a career as well. So their poll rating is perhaps more important than the honor and dignity with which they carry out their representative duties. But to go back to that Irish example, the point was that political parties just could not reach an agreement on this issue. So they went back to basics. They went back to the citizenry, the electorate, and they heard representations from all manner of different groups, and they heard representations also in a way that just is not possible through the press, for example, because the press, of course, is biased and the press has its agenda. And again, what they found in Ireland was that people who had very firm views on abortion, and much of which was inherited and, you know, as a result of the background they came from and the environment in which they'd grown up, they were challenged and they changed their mind. And this citizens' assembly approach is a way of doing that. And then not spelling out policy for an elected government, but giving a kind of foundation on which, and a check as well, and a means of accountability for voters to hold governments to account at the end of an electoral cycle.
Right. Well, when we talk about this, I heard the other day that a surprising thing happening in the United States, where there is this immense polarization in politics, Democrats and Republicans, that some trials with people coming together across the party lines and discussing particular problems are proving to be very productive and indeed creating some positive outcomes. But that is, of course, an example of a parliamentary system that is very much under pressure from this polarizing force. But now let's move a little bit forward and certainly there are many dimensions in this, in the way, the social contract way of thinking. We have been talking about both economic, social, not perhaps, there's also geographical dimensions, for example, in Norway, very clear in politics. And when it comes to cultural elements as well, perhaps not so strongly present in Norway to that extent these days. But we have to ask the question, why, now we're sitting here talking about this, the potentialities of thinking more along the lines of a social contract when you look into the future. And why is this kind of idea so relevant and important just now? We should include both an implicit understanding of a social contract, but maybe also you may have a more explicit kind of ambition in that. But why do you think it's important, just so important now? We wouldn't easily be sitting here 10 years ago speaking about this, I think. But now it's suddenly more natural, it seems like.
I think so. Why? Well, generally, you know, let's just reflect on the past 10 years. We had the financial crash, and that was another revelation of the fact that degrees of risk, tolerance on returns, reporting standards in the financial services industries were very poor. A lot of people suffered. You talked about the oil price crash halfway through the last decade. Now we've had the pandemic, which again has exposed many holes in the fabric of society all over the world. But to focus on Norway specifically, I think there are probably, to my mind, three practical imperatives. We know that we need to reduce oil fund spending. And that's something that governments have been aware of for a long time, but haven't really done very much about. We've got an aging population here, as we have in every developed country. Big implications for fiscal policy. We've got the changing nature of work. We also know that we need greater economic diversification and tough decisions on legacy industries like oil, but others besides, metals and mining perhaps as well. Not just for fiscal reasons, but for the sake of future prospects for current and coming generations. We've talked about the changing nature of the class structure, the fact that much of what used to be stable working class work is now seasonal or temporary or short-term contracts. And then against all of this, or the backdrop behind all of this, is global imperatives, climate change, the pandemic. For the first time, we can't afford to think about a social contract drawn up in terms of a national jurisdiction. It has to be the global jurisdiction. We have to think in terms of global public goods, the global commons, the global social contract.
Actually, we'll talk more about that in the next episode. I'm quite sure we'll dig more into that, those different areas where we can see the relevancy of thinking along those lines in a way. And what about, do we have some preliminary ideas about what should an ideal social contract look like in a way? I mean,
I think it extends from things that will be very obvious, like the rule of law and judicial discretion. So the degree to which the way in which the law is applied and the degree to which lawyers and judges take account of social and economic factors when prosecuting crimes, for example. And I know that there's a great tradition of restorative justice in Norway already. Basic freedoms, speech, expression, worship, religion, that kind of thing. But then more specific things on work, for example, the degree to which people can expect the state to provide a stable working environment, income and wealth equality. I think banking, savings and investment is an increasingly important thing, not just to avoid, hopefully, a repeat of the last financial crash at the beginning of the 2010s, but also in recognition of the fact that many of the really essential costs in life, housing, most notably, are increasing at rates way above the increase in salaries. And that implies a need for financing and a financial services industry that can support people who do not have great amounts of disposable income. Obligations to fellow citizens in the States. It could even include things like energy. You know, what kind of energy mix do we want in this country? Where should this energy come from? What's an acceptable level of pollution, carbon pollution, as we go through the energy transition? When it comes to health and medical care, thoughts on things like assisted dying, you know, and that kind of thing. Again, that's the realm of a similar realm to the Irish abortion debate. That's deeply controversial, and it's the sort of thing that should be put to some kind of assembly. Obviously, things like education, transportation, public transport, but then perhaps more abstract things like personal growth. We're liberals, you and I, Lars Peder, and we basically think that to be a liberal is to try to give everybody the best chance of leading the life they want to live, free from outside influence. It's not necessarily earning as much as possible or buying as much as possible. It's choosing the life you want to live and leading a life that's meaningful to you. And factors like that, I think, should also be intrinsic motivation, in other words, included in an ideal social contract.
Mm. Well, that's certainly a long list and that we could explore, and we don't have the time to do that now. I would, if I should introduce another kind of element into that, I would be very much to talk about more of, to me, I think an ideal social contract can also be seen in a directional sense that ideally, I think it would be it should express a platform for what I would call liberal progress in a way. And that would mean that more and more people have better opportunities and more chances in life to live independent, self-determined lives in a meaningful way. If I would say, what should it maximize? Some kind of a social contract. I would say we should try to maximize opportunities and life options for everyone, not for the whole people, and subject to a basic flaw in a way, and it's some basic security that mm-hmm. is there for everyone, and it's certainly not a single issue or a single policy will do that, but it certainly will be a family of different policies, like more approaching your list
exactly
in a way.
Yeah.
So that would, I think, be my. I would feel as a liberal a little bit naked if I didn't have some good answers to these kind of questions.
Perhaps that's the great problem with liberalism. Certainly, you know, since the great reform years of Beveridge and so on, after he was formulating his thoughts on welfare policy before the Second World War, but they came into being after. It's all very well and good talking in relatively abstract terms about liberty and equality of opportunity and wanting everybody to have the best prospects possible. But I think there does need to be some definition there, because without that definition, you have no anchor, right? You have no standard against which you can test yourself, but more importantly, against which voters can test governments.
Well, I think we can easily agree that we need to be more specific. We need to get into a more concrete setting, but that will save for, I think, the next two episodes. We'll expand upon that. You mentioned William Beveridge, of course, with the Beveridge reports. Those were important inspirations for designing the Norwegian welfare, universal welfare state, and also for Scandinavian examples as well. So there is this cross-fertilization of ideas across countries was, of course, always in place. And you may also know that the exile government in Norway was placed in London during the Second World War. And certainly, well, some would say that also the settlement after the Second World War is a very expanded kind of a new settlement that, you know, also changed the future in many ways. So, well, I think We should round off here now. We could talk and talk, but I'll round off. Guy, thank you so much for the conversation today. And I'm already looking forward to our next episode. And I hope our listeners are also looking forward to that, where we'll look more closely into areas like globalization and the future of work, housing, and more, and so on. So now at the end, I will switch to Norwegian.
Yep, okay.
Okay. Før vi avslutter, så vil jeg minne om muligheten til å også hjelpe oss gjennom å legge en kommentar på iTunes podcast og gi oss gjerne så mange stjerner som du synes vi fortjener. Det vil gjøre at vi vil nå flere lyttere. Hvis du ikke abonnerer på podcasten til Civita allerede, så kan du gjøre det gjennom å klikke på abonner på den plattformen du benytter når du hører på podcasten. Hvis du vil holde deg oppdatert på hva som skjer i Civita, så anbefaler jeg deg å melde deg på Civitas nyhetsbrev. Det finner du på civita.no. Og så er det slik at Guy og jeg vil gjerne ha innspill, kommentarer til et type tema vi tar opp her nå. Og hvis du har noen sånne innspill, så er du kan du bare sende en e-post, og da send den da til meg. Det er lettere å skrive på norsk, for å si det sånn. Og det er til larspeder@civita.no, også larspeder i et ord, @civita.no. Da vil jeg takke for at du hørte på, og på igjen her.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne media.